these events and ceremonies?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, it is important to understand that commemorating the event of Ashura is highly recommended, and it is considered to be tantamount to respecting the sha'air of Allah, or the signs and symbols of religion. وَمَنْ يُعَظِّمْ شَعَائِرَ اللَّهِ فَإِنَّهَا مِنْ تَقْوَى الْقُلُوبِ. So this is a verse from the Holy Quran. And there's no doubt as to the fact that holding ceremonies and commemorating the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam, the grandson of the Prophet, peace be upon him and his family,
yes, is
one of the sha'air of God, one of the symbols of religion. So imagine how effective and instrumental these commemorations are in resuscitating the tree of Islam. In other words, such commemorations do inject fresh blood into the veins of the Islamic Ummah. Such commemorations indeed teach the Ummah lessons of sacrifice, dedication, and devotion. So let's not forget that there is no doubt that the tragedy of Karbala, when it is attributed to the killers, there is no doubt that it is a criminal act. It is one of the most heinous act committed in the human, in the entire human history.
Mm-hmm.
So the event of Karbala, when it is in fact ascribed to Imam Hussein himself, it definitely represents a conscious confrontation, a conscious encounter, and actually a courageous resistance for a sacred cause and a very holy objective. Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam embarked on a journey from Medina to Karbala to fight evil, to fight injustice, and prevent the destruction of the religion of Islam, his grandfather's religion,
mm-hmm.
brought forth from the heavens.
Yes.
So it was at a time when the whole nation of Islam had failed to stand up to a person, a drunkard like Yazid, actually. They had succumbed to his will and to his dictatorship and to deviation, of course,
right.
The nation of Islam. So Imam Hussein, seeing the regression towards the pre-Islamic era, embarked on this revolution only to save the nation of Islam and to put the religion on the right track.
Right. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of Muharram and Imam Hussein. And in particular, before the break, Sheikh Javid, we talked about the manner that our people, in fact, both, Muslim and Shiite in particular, hold the ceremonies and rituals related to this month, to this holy and solid month. Is there anything left about the month of, the mourning ceremony, as well as the purpose of holding such ceremonies?
Yeah, well, of course. When it comes to the purpose, I was trying to make a point, and then that was, imagine what would happen if Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam was passive,
yes,
like other people. Now, inaction and passiveness by Imam Hussein in that very particular situation would have meant the end of Islam, or the, the destruction of Islam as we know it very well. So Imam Hussein took upon himself the responsibility of the whole nation.
The
greatest tragedy was that one who stood up for the noblest causes, which was obviously the defense of Islam, was cut down in a cruel manner.
Yes.
So it is for this reason that the sacrifice of Imam Hussein is commemorated annually by Muslims across the world. And our sorrow indeed on the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam never abates, and because this every year we see that Muslims across the Islamic world, across the world indeed, remind themselves of the tragedy that occurred 1,400 years ago. And the commemoration of Ashura indeed on the 10th of Muharram every year serves to remind us of the sacrifices of the family of the Prophet. And it also makes us aware of the people then and now who tried to destroy Islam and the family of the Prophet, peace be upon him and his family. And all that they stood for, as well as those who watched and listened and did nothing. So we are reminded of all these things. And I have a concluding point here. The whole purpose or the concept of mourning during Ashura is indeed to respect. So this is the main point, to respect the symbols of religion and remember the suffering of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam, his companions, and his uprising to defend Islam and prevent the destruction of the religion by the Banu Umayyad dynasty. So it is necessary to narrate the story of the sacrifices and listen to those who narrate this event. The aim is to learn lessons from this great event.
Thank you very much, Javed. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Don't go away.
Send me to Karbala, leave me there. Send me to Karbala, leave me there. Send me to Karbala, leave me there. Leave me there. What's there?
Back to the program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of Muharram based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javed, we all know that, it's quite widespread and it's very common among the Shiites and even some other denominations of Islam. They go to the mosque and they listen to the lectures and sermons given by religious scholars about this, sad month and about the brutal martyrdom of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Holy Prophet. But sometimes it's good to know some of the characteristics, some of the personal traits of Imam Hussein, because we all listen, for example, to the stories and the tragic event that happened, in fact, in Karbala at that time. But it's good also and more appropriate maybe to ponder upon and contemplate some of the characteristics of Imam Hussein, especially addressing the youngsters, you know, the youth, they need to know some of the traits of Imam Hussein. What are those traits that they need to know?
Well, of course, there are different aspects of his character which we need to know. Basically, if we want to know Imam Hussein, there are two kinds of understanding. You know, we come across people who just know Imam Hussein by name and by his father's name. So this is just a nominal understanding of the chief of the martyrs.
Yes.
That's not enough. We need to have profound understanding of the life, traits, attributes, and virtues of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam, and the goals and objectives behind his revolution. So the understanding should cover all aspects of his life and his character from the day he was born until he was martyred brutally by his enemies. Now, it is said that when the Holy Prophet, when Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam was born, the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family took the child in his arm, and of course, and there was a feeling of sadness, grief, and also happiness.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, some of the people around the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, especially the ladies, mm-hmm. they were astonished seeing the Prophet. Why is the Prophet so sad and you see, and he is actually the Prophet was crying at that time, and there were ladies, as it is reported, according to some reports, Asma asked the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, why are you crying, O Messenger of Allah? You know, the child has just been born, and we wonder why you are crying. Of course,
normally people are happy about the birth of a child.
It is an occasion where in which everyone is supposed to be happy, but the Prophet, there was a mixed feeling of happiness and sadness at that time. So even the Prophet is reported to have wept, and when asked why you are weeping, he said that I weep for the day when my grandson will be brutally martyred by some people, and those are the people who will never gain my shafa'ah.
Mm.
I will never intercede them.
Mm.
And he actually prayed that my shafa'ah will not benefit them. Mm. There is no shafa'ah for them.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, and thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We bid you farewell, and please keep us in your du'as and supplication wherever you go, especially when you go to the mosque and weep for Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his close and loyal companions. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Hussein, ya Hussein. حسين أبا عبد الله يا منهج يكار الله حسين أبا عبد الله دارك أبد ما ننسى حسين أبا عبد الله يا منهج يكار الله حسين أبا عبد الله دارك أبد ما ننسى.
My aid I do send, to your call I'll stand, ready to defend till the very end. For this faith I'll fight, it's the greatest plight, I'll give all my might, I'll serve day and night. Imam, to your call I will give my all, and if my legs fail me, to you I'll crawl.
Hussein Aba Abdillah, ya man had you dar Allah, Hussein Aba Abdillah, darak abad ma ninsa.
Midstream. 45 years after every internal event or presidential election, the West, its allies and agents in the region and beyond have bet on the future of the Iranian Islamic Revolution, which has so far defied all internal and external calculations. This revolution has proven itself once again after the election of reformer Masoud Pezeshkian as president, demonstrating its ideological and political maturity despite all the dangers it has faced over the years. The message sent by President-elect Pezeshkian to Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, addressing him first even before taking office, aimed to show the entire world that the revolution remains steadfast and any bets against its principles are bound to fail now and always. President Pezeshkian's second message to the head of Hamas Political Bureau, Ismail Haniyeh, reaffirmed the unwavering stance of the Iranian Revolution in supporting the central cause for all Arabs and Muslims, which is Palestine. The phone calls between Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, Russian President Putin, and Chinese President Xi Jinping with President-elect Pezeshkian came to confirm the continuation of Tehran's strategic approach in its relations with its allies. Without them, Iran would have been in a tougher situation. And without Iran, they would have also been in a difficult position, especially at this stage facing complex and serious regional and international challenges due to the situation in Ukraine, the imperialist colonial Zionist conspiracy against the Palestinian people with their divine patience. As for Western diplomatic circles, they expect, even wish, for President Pezeshkian to open channels of dialogue with Washington and Western capitals, as he promised during the election campaign, aiming to return to the nuclear agreement. They suggest that Washington will require Pezeshkian to show some lukewarmness in Iran's relations with both Beijing and Moscow, forgetting that it was President Trump who withdrew from the nuclear agreement, not Tehran. It was Tehran that faced hostility from Washington because it resisted and thwarted the imperialist West's plans during the so-called Arab Spring years. If those plans had succeeded, Iran would have also found itself in an undesirable situation due to the conspiracies of the imperialist West and its allies in the region. Regardless of the speculation about Iran's future policies under its new president, one thing remains evident. Imperialist, colonial, and Zionist agendas persist in manipulating Arab and Islamic public opinion. These forces continue to sideline critical issues that have long been the primary source of suffering for the region's peoples. Meanwhile, Iran will continue to support the peoples of the region to attain full liberation from the fangs of imperialism and Zionist colonialism. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The state and government in Iran have proven that they operate within an institutional framework. What the regime strives for is a strong state with influence beyond its borders and the ability to adapt for its interests. But will President Pezeshkian bring about radical changes? To discuss this issue with us from Tehran is Mr. Tara Sadiqi, political commentator and co-host of Twice Told Tales podcast. Thank you very much for being with us, Ms. Satara. Now, amidst regional conflict and political upheaval, Iran's political system has demonstrated stability by actually electing President Pezeshkian. But the main question asked everywhere, especially on hostile Western mainstream media, is are there any radical changes with Iranian President Pezeshkian taking power?
Thanks for having me. As you mentioned, Iran has been very stable in the stability during even the things that happened after the passing away of our president, our foreign minister, and the other officials shows that Iran has a strong political system that does not that is not affected easily by the events in the not only in the region but also in the country. I think for any country that has a strongly established system does not witness radical changes when the heads of the governments change, because there is a framework, there is a basis, a foundation, a strong foundation that the executive powers, as well as the other branches of the power, work within that frame and based on that foundation. So while certain things are going to be very different with regards to both foreign policy and domestic policy, we're not going to see radical changes because Iran is a stable country with a very well-established political system. And, you know, we had a snap election. We lost our president, our foreign minister. This was chaos enough for many countries to go through. But for Iran, we had a very peaceful transition of power, and which is still going on. And we had we held our elections for two different rounds, and the country elected their new president.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Sattari, we did see that Mr. President Pezeshkian reaffirming the strong stance of the Islamic Republic of Iran beside regional resistance factions, namely Hezbollah and Hamas, which really is the very big concern for the West right here. They want to support both Hamas and Hezbollah in their fight against Zionist Israel, and they want to stick to that support. Did the Iranian public ever doubt during this transitional period that this will be the case with the soon adopted foreign policy, that they will shift maybe, or that they knew that their government will just stick to its foreign policy?
Well, the majority of the people know that this is one of the main principles of Iran's foreign policy, and the Iran's support for resistance will never be wavered. It's going to continue no matter who becomes the president, because all these presidents believe on those principles that the country upholds. So I think the majority of people knew, and there were no doubts about it. But their concerns may be about how the new president is going to establish alliances and relations with the other countries in the region that would, in a way, affect Iran's support for the resistant groups. But whether or not Iran would continue to support the resistant groups was never a question. And mm-hmm. That's a given fact that we all know about Iran's foreign policy.
I think the main issue was that President Pezeshkian is a reformist, and we did see many, he's the third reformist president, if I'm not mistaken, and we did see reformist presidents before him who continued to support. Nonetheless, even the support was greater at some point, militarily I speak, because it was during the years of the global war in Syria. So in that particular case, is there public support for it, or some people would like to see less of that support?
This is what the majority of the people want, because it's not only that we're offering support for another country of our, which is our friend, it's also a part of Iran's national security. Israel is not a threat only to those resistant groups and the countries of the region, but also a big threat to Iran's national security. And I mean, it tries to be, at least. We see that as a form of repelling the threats by Israel. I mean, Israel has been trying to create chaos and attack and assassinate, and there's a long list and record of hostility towards Iran, and Iran's alliance with the regional countries and support for resistant groups is just part of that, that the people want to stay, and that's a part of our national security that people want to see continued.
Mm-hmm. Well, with Mr. Masoud Pezeshkian's presidency, what do you think are the prospects and challenges of for the Islamic Republic of Iran in potentially maybe trying to return to the JCPOA nuclear agreement? I mean, how might this administration approach negotiations with the international community in the event Trump again is to become a president, and he's the one who actually withdrew from the JCPOA to begin with? If he's back in the White House, what kind of strategy does President Pezeshkian has to approach this negotiation?
Well, when Mr. Pezeshkian was the member of parliament, in a speech he at the parliament, he mentioned that we cannot expect the U.S. to return, and we cannot trust the U.S. because it has once violated and breached its commitments to the deal. But during the campaigns, and that's what Iran has been doing, he mentioned that we need to find a way and work towards removing the sanctions in order to bring some economic ease to the country, because as that's the answer to your question with regards to what are the main challenges. One of the main challenges of the Islamic Republic right now and the new president is solving the economic issues and problems that the country is going through. And as a part of working towards that, Mr. Pezeshkian suggested that he's going to work towards removing the, getting the deal and returning to the JCPOA and removing the sanctions. However, we need to know that right now and for the past months is there is a negotiation team by late President Mr. Raisi that has been working on confidential negotiations through Oman to see how or if it's possible for the U.S. to return to the deal. And they're working with the other European and with China and Russia, the now formerly 5+1, but now 4+1 group. They're working to see what are the what is the mechanism, what are the procedures to revive the JCPOA. But to be honest, it looks like the U.S. has no intention and is dragging its feet. So this is going to be a main challenge, reviving the JCPOA without the U.S. And making sure that the European partners will actually stay or abide by their commitments, because they also failed. I mean, the U.S. withdrew, but the European partners of the deal also failed to abide by their commitments. So this is going to be a main challenge of the foreign policy, especially that has been promised to the people that he's going to work towards that, and that's going to bring about some major changes in the economic situation of the country.
In 1 minute, if that doesn't work, what other plan does Mr. Pezeshkian have?
Well, I think by now, because we have the experience of trying to reach a deal in the first place, and then seeing Trump withdrawing from the U.S., withdrawing from the deal, now the president-elect has a more like he's relying more on domestic capabilities and on forming alliances with other countries. That's also what he has mentioned, that he's not going to focus on only forming alliances or reaching a deal with the West. He's going to work with Eastern partners and partners from the global South to see how it could help with developing Iran's economy and bringing about more economic ease.
Well, Sitara Sadiqi, political commentator and co-host of Twice Told Tales podcast, thanks a million for being with us to explain how things are going after the election of the new president, Mr. Pezeshkian. Ladies and gents, stay tuned, because next we will be talking about the shattered Zionist economy.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Israeli businesses have been forced to shut as a result of the ongoing war and its devastating effect on the economy. Hebrew newspaper Maariv reported on 10th of July, referring to Zionist Israel as a country in collapse. More details in the following report.
Since the genocidal war in Gaza began, thousands of businesses have shut down in Zionist Israel, intensifying the economic crisis in the occupation entity. Zionist Israeli Kofas BDI, a company specializing in business information and credit risk management, reports that since October 7, 46,000 Israeli entity businesses have closed their doors. Yoel Amir, CEO of Kofas BDI, explained to Maariv, a Zionist daily newspaper, that this high number spans many sectors. About 77% of these closures, roughly 35,000 businesses, are small enterprises with up to five employees. According to Kofas BDI's risk rating, widely used by companies in the Israeli entity economy, including the banking system and international credit insurance companies, the construction industry and its ecosystem, ceramics, air conditioning, aluminum, and building materials are the most vulnerable. The report estimates that by the end of 2024, around 60,000 businesses in Zionist Israel may close. The crate sector, encompassing fashion, footwear, furniture, housewares, and services like cafes, entertainment, leisure, and transportation, has been hit hard. Additionally, the tourism industry is suffering from almost no foreign visitors, worsened by declining national morale and tourist areas now resembling combat zones. The agriculture sector, predominantly located in confrontation areas in the south and north, also faces manpower shortages. The economic damage is extensive. When companies shut down and fail to meet their financial obligations, the effects ripple out to impact customers, suppliers, and others within their ecosystem. Since the beginning of 2024, the Israeli regime's budget has recorded a cumulative deficit of 26 billion shekels, equivalent to about $7 billion. According to Maariv, the monthly budget deficit in March alone reached 15 billion shekels, or about $4 billion U.S. dollars, equating to 6.2% of the GDP. Moreover, the war has pushed Zionist Israel's debt to record levels since October 2023, reaching $43 billion U.S. dollars by April 2024, a figure that has doubled according to the Ministry of Finance of the entity. According to the data released by the Bank of Israel in late April 2024, Zionist Israel's war on the Gaza Strip has cost the occupation at least $67 billion so far.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Hassan Younes. He is an expert in economy, specialized in international business management, educational administration, and educational leadership. Thanks a million for being with us, Dr. Younes. Now, how does the closure of 46,000 businesses since the beginning of the war impact the long-term economic stability of Zionist Israel?
Yep. Thanks a lot for hosting me, Dr. Marwa. Actually, when we talk about the genocidal Israeli war on Gaza, we can't only take the aspect of what's happening in the battlefield or the military aspect. There is a war of narratives, and the resistance movements are having the upper hand in the war of narratives. The Israeli movements are having the upper hand in the military field, and apparently the resistance movements are having the upper hand from an economic perspective. What's happening in Israel is definitely an economic collapse. We have witnessed a slow growth in the economy. There are 46 businesses closing. The number is expected to grow to reach 60,000 businesses by the end of the year. This has a great impact on all the economic indications in the country, talking about inflation, recession, talking about the ability of the Israeli regime to attract capital. We are witnessing capital flight because the appetite of the international donors is decreasing. The credit worthiness of Israel or the Israeli entity is diminishing to a record level. The ranking of the Israeli economy has an impact on its credit worthiness. And the 46 businesses which are closing are from different sectors, mm-hmm. from all the sectors that you can imagine. And mostly they are small and medium enterprises. And these SMEs or small and medium enterprises, they are the backbone of any economy. Entrepreneurs are not investing in Israel. And the big donors are not sending enough capital to Israel. And if they are sending these gifts or donations are not invested in the right sectors. They are invested in immediate relief and not in infrastructural projects which are highly needed in Israel. And they are only for expenditure purposes and not for reinvesting purposes. Mm-hmm. These indicators are very negative in any economy. They are the indicators of developing countries rather than developed countries. And Israel always claims to be a developed country. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about business closures. We are talking about diversion of governmental spending. We are talking about decrease in the foreign investment, the hesitancy of the developed countries to invest in Israel. Definitely they are hesitant because of this war. Usually when we talk about any organization, and I perceive a country or an entity as an organization, we usually talk about the goodwill. Israel is witnessing an unprecedented ill will. This ill will is due to the bad reputation. In addition to the military aspect, the bad reputation due to the war of narratives decreases the appetite of investment and decreases the propensity of the major countries to invest or send money to Israel.
Yes, something quite interesting, Dr. Yunus, is that the substantial war expenditure has significantly increased Zionist Israel's debt, reaching record levels with a $67 billion U.S. dollar war expenditure so far. How do you think that that will be translated on Zionist Israel's internal fiscal health and probably also international credit standing?
Yeah. So the impact of this number, the $67 billion, is not only the $67 billion, which is huge and which is unprecedented. The problem is in the credit ranking or credit rating. Mm-hmm. Israel will face difficulties in getting credits or getting gifts or getting donations in the future. And even if they want to borrow money, the propensity of the international organizations to lend Israel money will decrease substantially due to this problem in credit rating. And these economic problems, in addition to the military problems they are facing, have an impact on different levels. For instance, around the number of expected tourists to Israel was supposed to be 1 million. And they've received only 200,000 tourists. Mm-hmm. So a substantial decrease in 80%. And usually such countries rely on the expenditures of tourists to give an injection to the economy. In the contrary, these numbers, we're not witnessing them in Lebanon. The number of tourists in Lebanon and the number of the Lebanese, the diaspora, coming back to Lebanon
actually,
is increasing substantially.
Far more, it's increasing than the years before.
It's increasing substantially. So when I want to compare figures from the different aspects, military, economically, tourists-wise, narratives-wise, the upper hand is always being to the resistance movements, as you can see, Maru.
Well, Dr. Yunus, trade and tourism, as you were mentioning, are essential for foreign exchange, for international relations. But could their downturn, these two sectors, the downturn of these sectors, diminish Zionist Israel's economic influence and maybe attractiveness as a destination for business, for tourism? Or is it just temporary setback and maybe after the war it will pick up again?
To pick up again, you need to invest in the infrastructure. The damage is big, Marwa. The supply chains when we talk about economy, we can't talk about only one sector. The different sectors are impacted. The supply chain, the chain which links the distributors to the retailers, to the wholesalers, to the manufacturers, it's being impacted. In many cases, it's being destroyed. The recovery is not easy. It's on the long term, and it requires investments from the international community or from the developed countries. And the credit ranking, the diminish in the credit ranking, would make this more difficult, definitely. And as I've mentioned, the ill will of the reputational damage of Israel has decreased the appetite. The boycotting movements, which we've done, also will decrease the appetite of the international brands, of the major franchisers, to give franchising agreements to Israel. So all these factors, accompanied with the decrease in tourism, with the lack of the injection of these foreign funds and foreign currencies in Israel, will also decrease the chances of recovery, or at least slow it down at an unprecedented figures.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, we think that this might be one of the consequences of starting a genocide, but that's just me saying. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Hassan Younis, expert in economics, specialized in international business management, educational administration, and education leadership. It's always a pleasure seeing you and talking to you. Hopefully we talk when liberation happens and we start talking about how the economy of Palestine will pick up, inshallah. Thanks a million for being with us. Ladies and gents, thank you. Please do stay tuned on the Middle East stream next week for more updates. عظم الله أجركم بمصاب أبا عبد الله الحسين for the calamity that befell on Ahlul Bayt, the family of the Prophet, for the martyrdom of Imam Hussein in Karbala. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In the United States, the Democratic Senator Bob Menendez has been convicted on all charges in a federal corruption trial and will be sentenced on 29th of October. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Fox News Channel has covered this story and tells us more. The jury in the federal corruption trial of Senator Bob Menendez, Democrat of New Jersey, and two of his business associates, Fred Dibes and Wael Hana, found Menendez guilty on all charges after a grueling 9-week trial in Manhattan, New York. Senator Bob Menendez pleaded not guilty to federal charges that he accepted an array of bribes in exchange for helping foreign governments. Jurors deliberated for 3 days. The conviction on all 16 counts against Menendez exposes the senator to a sentence of more than 200 years in prison, though such a heavy sentence is unlikely. The judge in the case scheduled the senator's sentencing date for 29th of October. Senator Bob Menendez condemned the decision in a statement outside the courtroom, so far refusing to resign despite overwhelming calls to do so. His attorney says they plan to appeal the verdict. "I'm deeply disappointed in the decision by the court of law," Bob Menendez said, claiming that he never violated a public oath and that he had never been a foreign agent. Prosecutors delivered a brief press conference outside of the courtroom following the verdict. The prosecutor said the case has always been about shocking levels of corruption. This wasn't politics as usual, this was politics for profit, according to U.S. Attorney for Southern District of New York, Damian Williams. Damian Williams added, "Years of selling Menendez's office for profit has finally come to an end." Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer responded to the court's verdict by calling on Senator Bob Menendez to resign immediately. Chuck Schumer said, "In light of this guilty verdict, Senator Menendez must now do what is right for his constituents, for the Senate and for our country, he must resign. New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy echoed Chuck Schumer's call in his own statement. New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy said Senator Menendez received a fair trial and due process of law as he was entitled to under our Constitution. I want to thank all the public servants who play crucial roles in our criminal justice system, including our law enforcement officials, prosecutors, defense attorneys, jurors, and judges. Their hard work ensured that these brazen crimes were proven beyond a reasonable doubt, and our nation is grateful for their service. New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy added, I reiterate my call for Senator Bob Menendez to resign immediately. In his 5-hour closing argument on Tuesday, 16th of July, federal prosecutor Paul Monteleone urged jurors to hold the New Jersey Democrat accountable for his alleged misconduct. This is a big case, Monteleone said, but it all boils down to a classic case of corruption on a massive scale. During the trial, prosecutors used cited emails and text messages from Menendez, as well as FBI testimony, to present evidence they argued shows the Democratic senator accepted extravagant gifts from foreign governments. The gifts totaled more than $100,000 worth of gold bars, in addition to hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash stuffed throughout Menendez's New Jersey home. Menendez was charged by federal prosecutors with 18 counts since he pleaded innocent last year, all relating to a multi-layer alleged bribery scheme involving Egypt and Qatar. In March, an 18-page indictment was wrapped into Menendez's existing charges already against him and his co-defendants, including his wife Nadine, for allegedly acting as a foreign agent and accepting hundreds of thousands of dollars in bribes to benefit the Egyptian government through his power and influence as a senator. The indictment came after co-defendant Jose Uribe, who allegedly gifted Nadine a Mercedes convertible, accepted a plea deal and agreed to cooperate with prosecutors. The charges also allege that Menendez committed conspiracy, bribery, and acted as a foreign agent, and extorted and wire fraud. CNN Cable News Network has also covered the same story and tells us more. A jury on Tuesday, 16th of July, found Senator Bob Menendez guilty on all counts in his federal corruption trial, and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer swiftly called on his Democratic colleague Bob Menendez to resign. Menendez of New Jersey was convicted of 16 counts, including bribery, extortion, wire fraud, obstruction of justice, and acting as a foreign agent for his role in a years-long bribery scheme. The verdict is a staggering blow for the Democratic establishment in New Jersey, where longtime state power broker George Norcross faces a separate racketeering indictment and a stain on the party's national brand. Bob Menendez, one of the most feared and influential figures in state politics, now faces decades in prison, and further questions about how he wielded his power as the former chairman of the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Obviously, I'm deeply, deeply disappointed by the jury's decision, Menendez told reporters outside of the courtroom. He added, I have every faith that the law and the facts did not sustain that decision, and that we will be successful upon appeal. Menendez faces sentencing on 29th of October this year, and he maintains he never violated his public oath and has never been anything but a patriot of my country and for my country. Menendez said, I have never, ever been a foreign agent, and the decision rendered by the jury today would put at risk every member of the U.S. Senate in terms of what they think a foreign agent would be. Damien Williams, the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, said after the court verdict, "This wasn't politics as usual. This was politics for profit." Bob Menendez appeared to shake his head when the first guilty verdict against him was read out. When the jury was finished, he leaned his elbows on the defense table with his hands clasped in front of his face. When the court officer announced there was a verdict and parties piled in, both Menendez's daughter, Alicia Menendez, and his sister sat in silence, looking straight ahead and not speaking. They seemed to embrace one another. As the senator left the courtroom, he walked over to his sister and daughter, spoke to them for a moment and left. They all had serious expressions on their faces. Even before his conviction, Menendez's case sparked a revolt among rank-and-file Democrats against the state party machine, which has for decades run roughshod over outsider candidates. The race to replace him, which began shortly after Menendez was indicted, initially featured First Lady Tammy Murphy. The surge of support for her from county party bosses over the more popular Representative Andy Kim, now the nominee, led to a grassroots backlash. "This is a sad and somber day for New Jersey and for our country," Andy Kim said in a statement on Tuesday. "Our public servants should work for the people, and today we saw the people judge Senator Menendez as guilty and unfit to serve the public. I call on Senator Menendez to stand down. When these charges were first made public, and now that he has been found guilty in a court of law, I believe the only course of action for him is to resign his seat immediately. The people of New Jersey deserve better."
Targeting of Palestinian children. The men and women of Gaza are busy piecing their lives back together, attempting bravely to cope with extensive loss of life and displacement, and thousands of innocent children suffer deep trauma every day since having their families, friends, homes, hospitals, schools, etc., deliberately, intentionally bombed by Israel with its military. The story of the suffering they experienced and continue to experience is told in the looks on their faces, full of sadness and despair, especially whenever they recall the 50 days of war they witnessed and survived in 2014. At the end of that war, the number of martyrs killed on the Palestinian side reached nearly 2,500, including 500 young children. The number of the wounded amassed to 12,000, of whom 3,300 were young children. Every child of Palestine now carries with them memories of explosions, of screams of horror, of seeing dismembered and burnt bodies, of the smell of death brought down on them by the inhumane, unconscionable actions of Israel in its efforts to oppress its occupied territory. A tank massacre here, an airstrike massacre there, is all justified by Israeli politicians and condoned by Western governments that protect these Israeli war criminals from ever facing justice in court.
"This is the first time I've entered the school since the incident. It's painful and depressing for me. Inside the school, I felt my brother's presence, as if he was calling my name. He was martyred here. I also got a sense that my mother wanted me to pray for him here. The feeling is of utter sadness and grief."
Hussein and Ibrahim are standing on the ruins of the house overlooking the school in the northern Gaza Strip town of Beit Hanun. This school belongs to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees. UNRWA is a UN organization. They recall back to the second day of the month of August 2014.
We are staying at the house of the late Shabab Ahmed al-Shinbari. Here there are 25 family members all living in a three-floor house, 150 square meters. The Israeli occupation forces targeted this house during its 2014 military aggression on the population of Gaza. We were evacuated quickly and headed to the UNRWA school in Beit Hanun shortly before our house was bombarded.
It was midnight when they blew a hole in our house with a tank shell about where we are sitting. We escaped to my uncle's second house, but they dropped gas bombs there. My aunt said we should prepare ourselves to go in different directions in the morning. We went to my aunt's house in Al-Gharmani Street, but the Jews entered and demanded us to leave. Finally, we went to the Western School at Beit Hanun.
We moved from our home on the first day of the ground incursion mounted by Israeli forces. We went to Beit Hanun Co-ed School A and D blocks. A municipal vehicle arrived on Thursday to transport us to another school because children at Beit Hanun had been hit by shrapnel. There was a bombardment near the school where we were sheltering.
We have informed the IDF, nearly 32 times about the school, its place, who were in that school, what they are doing, and everything. That it is should be a safe place. That you have the UN flags and the GPS had been sent to the Israeli side. The real information in real time. We were sending them every day about everything.
Officials at the UNRWA Relief Agency in Gaza believed Israeli army assurances regarding the guaranteed safety of their accommodation centers, accordingly informing the displaced people that a school in Beit Hanun, which was sheltering hundreds of Palestinian refugees, was a safe zone. Like blood to a vampire, however, this gathering of displaced families incited the appetite of the Israeli occupation army for killing, which found easy prey. They informed the UNRWA Relief Agency and International Red Cross to evacuate the school of the displaced. The people gathered in the school yard and waited for the arrival of buses to take them somewhere safe, all of them a clear and easy target for slaughter. The Israelis rounded them up and killed 16 of them where they stood, mostly children, and wounded more than 55 others.
The Red Cross came 2 days earlier. There were 3 Red Cross vehicles and 10 Red Crescent vehicles. They announced that they came to transport the most serious cases, such as those with disabilities, the elderly, and the injured, mostly shrapnel injuries. As they took people away, we asked them what was going on, and if they thought the school was safe. They confirmed it was safe and that there was nothing to fear. We trusted that information. The UN and the Red Cross came 2 days later with buses to move more of us to the Jabalia refuge camp. People gathered in together and we all went downstairs.
My aunt was collecting laundry and about to sit and rest when the shells pounded us. Shrapnel sliced open my stomach and my intestines fell to the ground. My brother found me lying underneath my siblings. He moved me outside and on foot he took me to the Kamal Odwan Hospital. They urgently referred me to Ashifa Hospital, where I went under surgery. 10 centimeters of my intestines were cut off. Now every time I eat and when I drink water, my stomach hurts.
Five of my family were martyred, praise be to Allah. 16 other people were injured, including Manar, who lost both her legs, Ibrahim, whose intestines were reconnected, and my brother Mahmoud, who had his arteries severed.
What happened in that school, it was a real catastrophe, actually. We have tens of people that had been killed and injured in that school. The Board of Inquiry investigated what happened in Beit Hanun school. It is a message, that here in the Gaza Strip, that there is no safe place, even in a school, on the street, at your shelter, to your home, everywhere. No safe place at that time.
We don't want to stay here at this school. They forced us to come here. We don't want to be here at this school. They are all liars.
People of the world find it impossible to believe that anyone, even a Zionist occupation force, would have the audacity to bomb the accommodation centers of the United Nations. The Israeli army had orders to kill anything that moved, and this policy was exercised throughout Gaza in their ground incursion. On the 16th of July, 2014, 8 children from the Bakr family went to play on the beach of Gaza. They were kicking around a soccer ball when from Israeli military ships in the sea, missiles fired on the beach, specifically targeting the children playing.